Well, it's funny because even me, like, I don't think of the seriousness of it all the time. But then when people like ask questions like that, I'm like, oh shit, like, yeah, this is actually a very high stakes game that I have to play 24/7.
Oh, hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Walt Drennan, and you're listening to Ask Me About My Type 1, the Q&A show all about type 1 diabetes. So I am officially back from my Slipstream weekend in California. I know there was an episode last week, but I actually had to upload that before I left for California, and then it went live while I was still in California, so I couldn't say anything about Slipstream last week, but now that I'm back, I can say that it was so great. I got to catch up with people that I had met in Slipstream's past, got to meet a whole lot of new people, and I was able to have some really great conversations about camp that I'm really excited to share with you in the next couple weeks. But just because the SoCal Slipstream is over doesn't mean that you still can't be a part of this season's camp episode. So if you're just a huge fan of Slipstreams and Type 1 Camp for Adults in general and would like to share your stories, please feel free to reach out. You can send me a DM on Instagram through @askmeaboutmytype1, or you can use the link at the end of the show notes of this episode to leave me a voicemail. I'd love to make you a part of this episode too. And now with all that said, let's get to this week's episode. So this conversation ended up covering some really big questions, and our answers got pretty deep in a way that I wasn't exactly expecting going into it. I have on Type 1 guest Erin and her friend and former college roommate Type None guest Jillian. Jillian's questions cover a whole range of topics, from the real dangers of Type 1 to whether or not Erin or I would have given it up had we the chance, and even what social media means to the Type 1 community. It was eye-opening to see Jillian's reactions to the very high-stakes decisions that Erin and I and everybody with Type 1 has to make on a daily basis, but how casually that we could talk about it. It reminded me of just how dangerous Type 1 diabetes actually is, but also the importance of not dwelling on that fact at the risk of missing out on the rest of our lives. So, thank you again for tuning in. And please remember to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast. Now, here's the episode. Okay. All right. Hi, guys. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting us.
How's your day going?
Hot.
It is very warm.
We're in a heat wave. Yeah.
Same.
Are you getting it down there, too?
Yes. Very much so. In the 90s. And it's very humid. I imagine it's humid where you guys are, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a sweaty Sunday.
So sweaty. All right. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Erin, let's start with you.
Okay. So I'm Erin. I'm the type 1. I've had diabetes for just over 9 years. I was diagnosed at the end of my sophomore year of high school. I was 16. I was so tired just all the time. I was peeing so much and drinking so much water. And I was like, my high school wasn't awesome. So I hated going to the bathroom in school. And one day I would go like twice in a class period. I spent like $20 on waters at the vending machines. And so I just got home one day. I was like, Mom, something is very wrong. I thought I had like a UTI or a bladder infection because I didn't know. So we went to the doctor after school. All they did was a urine test, and they were like, okay, you should pack a bag and go up to Children's. We live an hour away from the city. I was like, what do you mean? And they didn't really, they kind of danced around the fact that I had diabetes. I think they didn't want to scare me, but they were like, you know, it's a Thursday night. Doctors are starting to take long weekends. So you might just be there for a while, but they'll get to you, you know, when they come back on Friday or Monday. And, you know, stupid Erin, like having no idea. I was like, yeah, okay, cool. So we went home, packed our bags, went up to Boston. I was there for a week.
Wow, a whole week?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I guess I never really asked about when, like in the time of year that people were diagnosed. Because I was diagnosed in the middle of the summer. So like there's no school to worry about. My parents were kind of like around all the time. And we were on vacation sort of. So it's interesting to hear that you were like at school. And you had stuff to do and having to navigate your symptoms while at school is interesting.
Yeah. At first, I was very against it. They were like, yeah, you might be here for a little bit. And I was like, no, I have like finals and projects and stuff to do. I was like, I've been having these symptoms for, you know, at least 6 weeks. So I can go do it for another week and come back. They were like, no, honey, no.
Not a good idea.
No.
Okay. All right, Jillian, what's your story?
I'm Jillian. I am type none. I met Erin. We were roommates in college. We first lived together sophomore year in the same suite in the same building. And then junior year, we both went abroad. And when we came back, we were roommates. She's the best roommate I'll ever have.
Were you abroad together in the same country or just abroad?
No, we were abroad actually separately. Erin went to Jordan and I went to South Africa. And when we came back, we lived together.
Okay. All right. And then how did you come to know Erin's type one? Like, do you remember like a very certain point knowing her that you're like, oh, wow, Erin has type one? Was there like an epiphany?
There was no epiphany because Erin is very open about it. And she's always been very open to answering questions that I had. So when I would watch or see or be near her when she was changing her pump, she would answer any questions that I had. And that I thought was just nice and that she was very informative. And so I never felt nervous or uncomfortable or had any questions or, you know.
Okay. So was it something that she presented to you or something that you just noticed and started asking about?
I think I noticed, but I also think that she told other people. And so that other people told me, so we never sat down and had like a full conversation about it.
Do you remember that, Erin?
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't usually present it to people. You know what I mean? It's pretty easy to like see my Omnipod or my Dexcom, or, you know, I take out my pager at mealtimes. And it's just so natural for me. Like, I'll explain it to my roommates or whoever is like in the most immediate area of me or who kind of like needs to know. But otherwise, people just kind of notice and it's part of my life. And if they ask questions, like, cool, I'm happy to explain.
It's a good way to go about it. Were you on the Omnipod in college, or what was your management like back
then? I was on the Omnipod, and I've actually been on it since pretty soon after my diagnosis. So it's the only pump I've ever had, which is cool. And same. I got my Dexcom maybe senior year of college.
I can imagine how that would be nice, having the Omnipod at the beginning of college. I got it literally months before I graduated college, just because, you know, it was invented. I think it came out in 2005, and that's when I started college. And then by the time I found out about it, it was 2009. So I've been on it since then. It's my first pump as well. That was a big selling point for me, the fact that it was very unnoticeable. All right, so let's get into Jillian's questions. But before we start that, it's the one rule that I have on the show. Is that Jillian, this is more for Jillian than anybody else, but if Jillian hears anything or hears any lingo that you just don't understand and you'd like clarification on, you can call what I've been trying to trend as well. I have a lot of words that I want to get out there. It's called a type one timeout. So if Erin and I start talking about something and we don't really go into detail or you just don't understand what it means, you can call a type one timeout. Everything stops and we explain whatever it is that you need explained until you get it. Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
I find in the type one community specifically, there's a lot of words and phrasing and just terms and ideas that we understand just because we've been living with it for however many years. They're very common and then we kind of just throw them around, very not really taking into account people that just don't understand what we're talking about. And this is my attempt at trying to open up the conversation. So type one timeout whenever you want. And then Erin, you can also use that too. If there's something that you feel like that you would like to go into more detail about, we can definitely stop and go from there. All right.
Sounds good.
Okay, Jillian, what's one of your questions?
Okay, my first question is, we talked about how you found out you were diabetic and what that, you know, actual process was and how you got there. But what was your first thought when you heard that you were diabetic?
I think my first question was, what is that? I had like no understanding. I had a big old crush on Nick Jonas, still do. So I knew he had it, but still like didn't know what it meant. And so I kind of just had the doctors like walk me through, but it was like a long, days long process of being walked through what it was and what it really meant. But I think the initial explanation was you'll have to take a medicine for the rest of your life, but it's okay because it's super treatable. You know, you don't feel well now, but you'll feel good really soon once you're on the medicine and used to it.
I was younger than Aaron was. I was 12. So it felt like I wasn't really being told. It was my parents that were being told. And then also the fact that, so we were actually in the middle of a move, like a really big move. We lived in South Texas and we were moving to Mexico City because of my dad's job. But we were in Pittsburgh at the time. And that's where I was diagnosed. I was only in the hospital for 3 days, but we were only there for about a month. So we had to get all of that initial education that people get in a very short time frame. So it was kind of a whirlwind for me. I mean, I was there and I definitely heard what was going on, but it wasn't, I don't think it really set in until maybe a few months after that, just because it wasn't really on me to take care of myself as much as maybe Aaron was. And then also my grandma was a nurse, or she was retired at that point, but she kept on, it was about a couple weeks of my symptoms, similar to Aaron's. I was going to the bathroom a lot. I was peeing a lot. I was drinking a lot. I was drinking all the wrong things. I was drinking a lot of orange juice and a lot of Mountain Dew, I remember specifically. So not the things you want to drink when your sugar is high.
Mine was Sunny D.
I know, right? looking back, it's just all the worst things you could drink when you're high. Mm-hmm. And then my grandma kept on saying, like, oh yeah, kind of sounds like diabetes. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that word. But she kept on kind of like playing it off. It's like, oh, it's fine. You just have to worry about what you eat for the rest of your life. That's it. You know, just get on a schedule. You'll be fine. Which was kind of what happened. Like, I was just put on a very kind of strict eating regimen. Like, it's just breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that was it. But then, like, it really set in probably maybe even a year after that, was that how different I would have to be for the rest of my life. So, yeah, I think it kind of hits you at different points, depending on when you were diagnosed and how attentive I think your medical team is. I think my medical team was pretty good, but probably better for my parents as opposed to me. Like, and I was just wasn't really all that curious. I was, you know, worrying about moving to a new school and making new friends. And like, there was a lot more going on in my life than just that, at that point, at least.
So we talked about, or you just mentioned a few, like Sunny D and orange juice and Mountain Dew. And you said that those are things that maybe you should stay away from when you're high. So high meaning high sugar levels. High, I mean, I don't know if this is a type 1 timeout or if this is just me looking for.
Well, you have to say it.
Type 1 timeout.
There you go. Trying to get it trending, guys. So you're trying to figure out what being means?
Yeah.
Or
so
what we mean when we say that?
Right. So when you say you're feeling high, is there a high and a low? What does that feel like? How do you know when you're high versus low versus maybe at like a good regular?
Basically, you should stay between certain numbers and it's different for everyone. I think normal pumps and stuff will tell you like below 70 or above 250 is where you don't want to be. I know people that try to have like way tighter control than that. But yeah, basically they're bad and dangerous for different reasons. Being low is more like immediate danger, is like how I like to explain it. That's where when I get like shaky or I say, you know, I need candy or soda, that's a low. And that's a quick fix. Just have some soda and I'll hop right back up. I need like two sips and I'll be fine. High is kind of like, for me at least, I think highs are harder to deal with because it's harder to come back down. I need to take more insulin and it's kind of like a waiting game because the insulin takes a little while to work and I get frustrated. Sometimes I will look at the high a few hours later that hasn't moved as fast as I would like it to and give myself more insulin, but that actually puts me in danger of being low because I've given myself more insulin. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, that what Aaron just was referring to. I don't know how many people call it this, but I call it stacking. So insulin, we call it fast acting, but really it kind of depends on how long you've been on it. But typically there's like a 15-minute window of when you inject to when it starts to work. And then there's also like a 3 to 4 hour window for it to be in your system to actually do the lowering of your sugar. So it's kind of, it's a big kind of guess and check kind of game. There's no real, there's a science to it, obviously, but there's also, it's an, also an art form kind of trying to get things at the right time. And also the waiting game, because like, so when you're high, it doesn't feel great. Like, I didn't recognize it as being high when I was younger, but I kind of can see, look back on it now as being just really achy all the time. I like to think of it as like the sugar is just building up inside of me and I can feel it, even though that's not really how it works. I call it crunchy, like my blood starts to feel muddy. But yeah, so it's like lows and highs are very physical symptoms. You know that you're low or high because you can feel it typically. A lot of people have CGMs, like Erin said she has the Dexcom, and that keeps a real-time measure of where your sugar's at any given point. But like being able to feel your highs and lows is really good too, just because, you know, sometimes those things don't work as well as they should, or, you know, there's malfunction. So it's not, they're not perfect, but they do help a lot. But basically, yeah, so highs feel, I do get aggravated, get really frustrated. What you were saying when you inject or bolus, when you give yourself like a quick shot of insulin, I call it rage bolusing, just because, you know, I kind of I crank it up to like 10 or 11 and just kind of like ride it out, even though that probably makes me low in the 3 to 4 hour window later. So yeah, it's a real trying to chase your sugars down can get frustrating and annoying, especially because like you don't get that immediate fix like you do sometimes with low blood sugars. Like if you eat something, it tends to feel better quicker as opposed to injecting and kind of just waiting it out, I think, at least.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree.
So does that answer your question?
Yes.
Or does that answer your type 1 timeout?
That answers my type 1 timeout.
Okay, perfect. Type 1 time in.
Type 1 time in. My next question, compared to when you first found out that you were diabetic to right now, so Aaron, almost like over 9 years, and Walt, more than 10 years, 19?
19 years, geez.
19 years.
Thanks for reminding me how old I am.
Sorry. So 19 years. So compared to when you first found out to right now, what are some of the misconceptions or stereotypes that you've realized maybe aren't true or that you'd like to correct people on?
There are so many. I don't know. I mean, there's definitely the stereotypes I get. Oh, but you don't look diabetic, as in like you're not overweight or you don't appear to be unhealthy. So how could you be diabetic?
What?
Can you eat that is a big one. But I think beyond those like stereotypes, a lot of what I'm finding more is just plain ignorance, like no idea of what diabetes or particularly type 1 is or what it's like. Because like I said earlier, I knew of one person who had it and it was a celebrity, but I had no idea about what it meant or what it did.
Yeah, I think I remember there was actually a girl in my fourth grade class that had type 1. She had diabetes. And it was something that was kind of just mentioned every now and again, but I never really took too much interest in it. Just because, oh, okay, that's what she has, you know, whatever. But then I'm actually just realizing that now. But other than that, I actually didn't even know any of the stereotypes like associated with it because I was 12 and I had grown up overseas mostly, so I wasn't really aware of any of the, I guess, American conceptions of type 1 or diabetes or anything like that. So I wasn't even like, I wasn't watching American TV, so I didn't hear the jokes or anything that you sometimes hear. So I was kind of going into it completely like a clean slate. I had no idea. But afterwards, I was very aware of it. I noticed those things a lot more probably now than I would have back then, just because it, you know, they're essentially talking about me. But yeah, so but like Aaron said, the classical definition of a type 1 or like the public perception of diabetes in general is that you don't take care of yourself. You did it to yourself. And it's something that you have to deal with. And I think that kind of those misconceptions particularly hurt us in like the fundraising aspect of it. Like people don't take diabetes research, let alone type 1 research, seriously, just because, like, oh, but they did it themselves. Like, why do they need my money to help? That's why I don't really particularly like the word diabetes, just because it's, like, so negatively associated with just those misconceptions and bad ideas that I feel like I like to use the type 1 phrase, just because people typically don't know what that means, and then I can kind of go into my explanation of what type 1 is. They eventually have to learn that it is diabetes, obviously, because that's what it is, but I think going into it that way is at least my preferred way of introducing it, as opposed to just, oh, I'm diabetic, or oh, I have diabetes. For the first few years, I hated the word, just because I didn't like the association with it. I've since starting the show, I've said it a lot more, but other than that, yeah. But those misconceptions, being overweight, doing it to yourself, not being able to eat what you want, those kinds of things.
That's kind of cool. I like how you frame it as introducing it as type 1 instead of diabetes, because I feel like when I say, oh, I have diabetes, the immediate thing is, like, I have to fend off those, you know, oh, how, what can you eat and stuff like that.
Or they just assume that they know what you're talking about already, just because they said, oh, it's a word I've heard and I kind of know what it means. So type 1 is like, oh, what's that? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I kind of go into the, oh, it's an autoimmune disorder. Like, I don't make insulin, kind of like the way you do. And then people, a lot of people don't even know what insulin is, and even though they make it. So I think it opens up a lot more better conversation, as opposed to just like saying, oh, I'm diabetic. But that's me. I feel there's a lot of people that love the word, and like they're like, they wear proudly. Some people get it tattooed on them. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's just too far gone. Like, it's too negative of a word to really change. And just because there's so many more type nuns than there are type ones in the world, it'd be easier just to give them a different idea of it, or a different way of thinking about it.
I'm going to have to try that out.
See what happens. Yeah. What about you, Jillian? What did you know about diabetes prior to meeting Aaron?
Yeah. So like you, I remember growing up in elementary school, there was a girl who was in my elementary school classes, you know, kindergarten through fifth grade, and she had type 1, and she would go to the nurse's office before lunch. And I just knew that she had her finger pricked and she came back with a Band-Aid. And that was really what I knew. And now...
So many Band-Aids.
So many Band-Aids. So many. And, like, doesn't that hurt? And so that was... I came to it with this, like, oh, my God, I hate getting my finger pricked. You have to do this every single day. And that was my full exposure. That was all I knew. And then, of course, I knew more type 2. More type 2 concerns in my family. So I knew, like, that stuff, but not nothing really about type 1, or nobody really explained a difference to me, or there was not that separation. So I see what you're saying with this, like, negative connotation around diabetes and the word, because when people would talk about diabetes to me, it was way more type 2 than it was type 1.
Yeah, there's a lot more type 2s out there than there are type 1s. A lot of the research goes towards that, just because obviously it's a bigger... It affects more people, so they're probably going to get a lot more funding for it. And it's just kind of a better business model, I guess, you know, going for what more people will use as opposed to fewer. And I think back in the day, I guess I'm not really sure, back, but, you know, in the Banting times, when Banting was a person that invented or discovered insulin, back in the day, it was a lot more serious. People, like children that were diagnosed with it, were dying within the year of being diagnosed. So I think people took it a lot more seriously back then, as opposed to now. Type 1 management has gotten really great over the years, and it's just gotten better and better, to the point where people don't realize that it is actually really dangerous, and we could still very easily die from it, basically. And a lot of people still do. And I think the insulin has definitely saved us, but it also kind of set back the public mindset of it, as it's, oh, it's not that big of a deal.
I think I have a type 1 timeout.
Go for it.
So type 1... You can die from it. So can I ask what happens to cause death of type 1? Does that make sense? Is this, like, such a bad question?
How can type 1 kill you?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Don't be.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Well, it's funny because I don't think of the seriousness of it all the time. But then when people, like, ask questions like that, I'm like, oh shit, like, yeah, this is actually a very high stakes game that I have to play 24/7. But I think it's also, like, exhausting to be in that mindset all the time. So you kind of have to, you know, move that aside and go along with your treatment. Like, it's not as serious. Just, you know, keep that in the back of your head. But you can die from both highs and lows, and also long-term, like, poor control. Poor control over time just kind of, like, wears down your organs. You can have, you know, toes and feet and fingers amputated, like, nerve damage. Your eyes are a big thing. But that's only if you don't control it over a very extended amount of time. Highs can kill you because you can go into something called DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis, and that's when too many ketones build up in your system. So basically, there's just too much sugar that your body can't get rid of, and eventually you go into a coma, and it's hard to come back from. I mean, people come back from it all the time, so it's not necessarily a death sentence, but it is very dangerous. And then on the opposite side, low blood sugar, like, you need some sugar in your blood just to be able to function. That can cause, I mean, you can pass out from that, and I think that one causes seizures as well. I'm lucky that I've never been on, like, the extreme end of either of those, but that can also kill you.
Yeah, basically, if sugar is the gas to your car and you run out of gas in your car, like, it stops working. So either your brain shuts down or your heart stops. There's seizures, which seizures in themselves can be pretty dangerous if you have one for long enough. But like Aaron was saying, it is something that is serious, but we can't, I would imagine it's very difficult for a type 1 to always have that, like, at the forefront of their head. Some people do, and it's really anxiety inducing, and it's tough on its own. But there is at a certain point where we get where it's like, we just kind of have to brush it off, just because if we didn't, we wouldn't be able to function normally. So it is that really weird tightrope walk where it is very serious, but we have to keep on living our life. So it is interesting being able to, or having to have that kind of dual conception of something that you have to live with for the rest of your life. But yeah, like Aaron said, high blood sugars. So the buildup of sugar in your blood actually makes it, and insulin is what your body needs to use that sugar. So if you just, and that's why one of the symptoms, early symptoms, is rapid weight loss. So, like, you can eat however much you want, but you're not going to gain any weight because your body isn't using the energy that the food turned into. And then that's why you're going to the bathroom a lot, because your body's trying to get rid of the sugar. And basically, what your body does is starts eating away at your fat, which then results in ketones, which is an acid. Basically, your blood becomes too acidic, or so acidic that it becomes poisonous, and then that's where you die from high sugars. And then the low sugars, basically your brain can just, you know, stop working because it doesn't have any energy to go off of. Highs tend to, a death from a high tends to be a lot more prolonged, and there's, theoretically, it's a bit easier to catch, whereas lows can happen really quickly. And also, insulin can actually get you so low to that point. Insulin has a very, like, a limited therapeutic range. It can get you to where you need to be, but it can also send you blood sugar so low that you're in trouble. So it's, insulin's very, can be dangerous just by itself, but we need it to live. It's a tightrope walk.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, a constant attempt, and the attempt isn't always super successful at just balancing.
Yeah, staying in that range that Aaron was talking about.
Wow. Thank you for answering. I'm sorry again if that was a lot.
I don't know how you felt about it, Aaron, but it's come up, actually, last season it came up once where, like, someone asked us, like, do you constantly feel, like, that fear of almost dying? And then I thought it was like, well, no, because you kind of can't go through life like that. Hmm. And we have to downplay it for ourselves, at least, just so that we can get by. But there are people that don't and take it very seriously all the time, and I don't know. It's definitely a psychological aspect of it.
Yeah, I think when I was first diagnosed, my constant fear was that I would go low in the middle of the night and, like, not wake up. And I was always just terrified of that because I really struggled with lows at first. But again, like, that's just not a way to live. And so I would try to switch that by, like, running myself high. But that's also not a way to live, because then I just always felt, like, so tired and grumpy. And I didn't want to, like, do anything, but my team was great in helping me, you know, figure out the middle ground and telling me I wasn't going to die. I remember going to an event after I was diagnosed at Children's, and it was a type 1 speaker. And at the end, he opened it up to Q&A, and I was with my parents, and they said, you know, she's afraid she's going to go to sleep and not wake up, and so are we. And he answered it. I don't even remember what his answer was, but it was kind of cool. After that, all the families kind of mingled, and I have like 6-year-olds coming up to me like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, you'll be fine. And they had type 1, and they were showing me all their gear. And so I was like, oh, okay. Like, no, this is going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the first few days, because the team, I guess, told my parents about that kind of possibility. And so the kind of the way to mitigate that is to test your blood sugar at like 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. in the morning. One time that they did that to test my sugar in the middle of the night, it was pitch black because I was obviously asleep. They tried to do it without waking me up, which did not work. They had the finger pricker to get my sugar. The cap came off and they lost it. It like rolled under the bed and it was too dark to find. So then they had to prick my finger without the cap, which then just kind of basically just stabs you because like the cap is there to like make sure it comes out. And then that was the end of that.
So then
I kind of get different stories from different people. Some say that their parents were very diligent about it. Some people say like the doctors never even told them to do that. Like it wasn't even considered kind of thing. So it definitely depends on who introduces type 1 to you, that those initial anxieties can kind of be exacerbated or kind of just diminished and just not even thought of. But yeah, for the longest time, like I didn't really think of Lowe's as anything just because I never really had them in that first beginning period. It wasn't until college and like the later years of college where I started stacking my insulin and like rage bolusing all the time. And I would, you know, I would pass out in the middle of the library and have seizures and had to get like carted away in the ambulance. Like it happened once, like twice in 2 weeks kind of thing. It's like it happened a lot in college. And I don't think it really hit me until now, like how serious those times were and like how lucky I was to like just be found by like a friend that happened to be an EMT, because even back then, like I didn't tell anybody about it. So they literally had no idea why I was like flopping on the floor seemingly out of nowhere. So yeah, it's definitely something that you have to arrive at it yourself, I think, just kind of like getting used to that fact so that you can keep on going with the rest of your life, because type 1 is a really big part of our lives, but it's not the only part.
Being a type 9, I remember one instance, and Erin, you might not even remember this because it might not have even been a big deal to you, but I remember it was finals week and we were in the library and I had like a study group, and you came to me and you were like, I think I need to go to the emergency room. Like something is wrong. I don't know. I think you were low and you were like, I need to go to the emergency room right now. Like it's not, something's wrong. And I think I didn't understand. And now hearing this, I definitely didn't understand at the time what that meant or what that could have meant. You know, I think I do remember living together and having like in the middle of the night, you'd snack in the middle of the night and you'd had like an emergency drawer underneath the bed. But I still did not understand like what those instances and what those moments meant. So now I do. So thank you both for sharing. I learned something.
That's what the show's about.
Well, thank you for like losing all the sleep over my eats and my snacks and being willing to just like let me interrupt a study group to be like, nope, we gotta go.
No, I didn't understand. I wish I did understand what that meant. And I'm always down to eat. So whenever those lows in the middle of the night came, I was always right there with you snacking.
Yeah.
Erin, have you ever gotten any questions or comments about your type 1 that like stopped you in your tracks or like were kind of odd at the moment? Like, have you gotten any weird questions? Like, so Jillian's question about like dying from type 1, it's not necessarily a weird question, but it's like a really thought-provoking one, and one like I've kind of like, people kind of dance around it, but it's a really important mm-hmm. question to ask, I think. But on the opposite side of that, are there any questions that you get that are silly or that you just don't like getting?
I have had people ask me if it's contagious. I and I'm a jerk, so sometimes I'll be like, yes, don't
which
come too
is,
close.
Everybody, it is contagious. No, it's not. No, it's not.
It's not. It's not it's at all. Not. But I'm like, some people, it just...
Only if you
like,
make out for a really long time, though.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, yeah, I should have told you that before we shared a drink.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no. Oops.
I can't believe people ask that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, so that's the one that always, like, makes me laugh. And then there are definitely some instances that have just stopped me. Maybe not even so much in the way of questions, but, like, comments. Like, I was working in retail, and I was cashing some people out, and my pod was, like, on the front of my arm, almost, like, above my bicep, so it was very visible. Yeah, exactly.
I'm wearing mine. I shared it to them. Yeah, that's what that was.
Yep. Yeah, so you could see it, and a lady started asking me about it, and I think most of her questions were normal. You know, oh, what is that for? What is it? You know, just whatever. I don't even remember. And then she was with someone else and they were like, okay, stop asking questions. Like, we gotta go. And she was like, oh no, she's fine answering the questions. She wouldn't, you know, put it on display like that if she didn't want the attention. I was like, I was stunned. It made me so mad. No, I don't want attention. Like, I'm just trying to live, and it's out of the way on my arm. That's it. It's like, it's a fine, I feel like a fine line, because I also kind of now think, like, oh my God, am I looking like I want attention? But, like, no, I mean, I'm open about it, but I'm not like, hey, let me tell you everything about diabetes.
Like an awareness builder. It's not like attention seeking. I feel like with you, just knowing you, you're always down to answer questions when it's respectful and spreading awareness and with the purpose of driving people and sharing knowledge. That's crazy that someone said it was like attention seeking.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely the worst one I've ever had.
That's awful.
Yeah.
Because I definitely get, sometimes I'll get questions about my, and I think, I don't know, maybe there's something to it because there are people that say like, oh, I'm going to wear my pump in this location just because I want people to see it. So there is, it's kind of a weird, not so much attention seeking, but like awareness building kind of thing. And I think there is kind of a fine line between that, especially when I'm alone. I think this actually happened yesterday. I was getting food at a, and Pittsburgh is a, there's a lot of hospitals here. So there's tons of people that work at hospitals, tons of doctors. People, I live like a block away from Children's Hospital. So I was getting food and there happened to be someone in scrubs. If anybody's walking around scrubs, obviously, you know that they work at the hospital. So he saw my pump and I happened to be low at the time. And he was like, oh, wow, what's that? And I think he kind of knew what it was, but he wanted to like confirm. He's like, oh, yeah, it's my pump. I was like, I did not want to have this conversation with this person trying to engage me in my hardware kind of thing. I was low. I just wanted to get my pizza and leave. And I think he could see it in my face. And there's just sometimes it's not attention seeking. It's just like, you know, that's where it is today. Sorry. Like, I'm not trying to, you know, give you a certificate in type 1 knowledge kind of thing. I suppose yeah. At that point, I think I'm not the greatest at explaining things, especially when I'm alone or low, ironically. That's why I think why I have the show to make up for it. I think he could tell that I just did not want to talk to him about it. And he kind of like just let it go. He's like, oh, is that an insulin pump? It's like, oh, wow, that's really slick. I was like, yeah, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's there. So I kind of feel bad now looking back on it. But like, I just wanted my pizza, dude.
That's funny you say that. I do the same thing when I'm low. You know, people will hear the beeps and, you know, get scared. What can I do? What can I do? I'm like, you can relax and just let me handle this. Or like, I kind of snap at people even before I know I'm low. And I'll come back to them later and be like, I'm not a bitch, I promise. My blood sugar was just low. I'm so sorry.
Fine line between being bitchy and being low.
I'm both at the same time.
Maybe this is a type 1 timeout. So the, okay, I know what's it, the yes, the mm-hmm. pump. Okay, I'm going to tell you, and this is probably awful, but somebody out in the sphere relates to this. It looks very much like a laundry pod.
A Tide pod?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've had people say that.
I call it a pod sometimes. It was probably me, Aaron. And it was probably Steve and Aaron.
So the brand name of the pump is Omnipod. And so you've probably heard me call it a pod.
A pod.
Yeah. I kind of like switch between calling it a pump and a pod.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people will connect it to like, oh, Tide Pods.
So
these are dangerous if you eat them too, so don't.
Don't eat them. So this pod, this Omnipod, you both have one, is that the newer version of the girl I knew in elementary school going to the nurse's office and pricking her finger? Is that like the newer innovative solution?
No. So I think kind of what you're asking is how we check our blood sugar. And I use the Dexcom, which is a CGM. That's like the smaller one,
yes.
The Dex. Yeah, the one that's like in a weird spot on my arm now. So basically that gives me the readings that I have like on my watch and my phone. And so I just have to look at that to know what my blood sugar is instead of, you know, taking out my meter and pricking my finger and testing my sugar. So yeah, that is like the new treatment for knowing your blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the pod / pump is the treatment that delivers your insulin.
Right. Okay. So the Omnipod delivers the insulin based on the result that you get from the Dex.
So it's not, they're not connected, or the, I don't know, Aaron, are you looping?
I'm not. I'm trying to learn, but it's so far above me.
Yeah. So there is, so that's actually a good question because I think people assume that they work together when they don't always, or it's like that actually that idea, or not the idea has been around for a while, but the actual like execution of it is happening in the next few years, or it's happening now. To where your pump will communicate with your CGM based on the numbers that it has and dose your insulin accordingly. Right now, they work separately. Like, the only thing connecting them is the person that's wearing them. So Erin now will look at the number under Dexcom and then type that into her pump, and then that'll, like, spit out as much insulin as that requires. So I think the doctor that I was speaking to last night, it's like, he assumed that the pump not only did the insulin but also did the sugar. Like, he just, you know, which, I mean, it's 2019. That's not, like, a very far-fetched idea to have, but it's been kind of, like, a hard nut to crack for a lot of medical supply companies. Omnipod is working on it. Their version of it is coming out in the next couple of years. But I think your friend in elementary school probably didn't either had a pump with a tube, because the Omnipod is just one kind of pump. There are a few out there now. Most of them have tubing. So you'll see people with what looks like a pager connected by a very like thin looking, kind of looks like fishing line. And then that's how the insulin gets into their body. Whereas ours is it's all kind of self-contained in that little pod thing that you see. I'm not sure how long ago elementary school was for her. So like, she might've been on MDIs, which is multiple daily injections. So pens or needles. And she just kind of stuck herself when she needed to. But there's definitely a difference. And what she was doing, like you said, was checking her blood sugar with her finger, which is what I still do. Like, I still prick my finger to get my sugar readings. So there's just different ways. It's just a few different ways of doing the same thing. That was a good type 1 timeout.
It was.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No.
Okay.
Don't
having a lot of these type 1 timeouts.
That's what they're for.
Can I call a type 1
yes,
timeout?
Yes, please.
To ask, can you explain looping a little more to me? So, like, I understand that it, like, streamlines it and, you know, they will work together to kind of act more like a normal pancreas would and, you know, readjust. I think it's every 5 minutes or whatever. Yeah. But, like, yeah, I just don't know.
Okay. I'm just going to preface this with all of my knowledge of looping is from Instagram. So if I'm wrong, you can blame Instagram. But basically, it's looping. There's a difference between closed loop and open loop kind of thing. But basically, it's there are people in Silicon Valley actually started realizing that the technology existed to be able to get your CGM information to work with your pump information so that they can like work side by side. And basically, your pump will then look at your sugars, kind of assess what you need based on those, and then just deliver your insulin automatically. Prior to that, basically, you had to do all that thinking for yourself. So you had to look at your sugars, kind of guesstimate what you needed in terms of insulin, and then kind of dial it into your pump, and then the pump would shoot that out. Now, with looping, it does that automatically with like an algorithm. The hard thing is the algorithm and getting it right, because the CGMs nowadays, they can predict what your sugar will be within like the next 30 minutes to an hour. And so using that information, your pump can either stop giving you insulin, just like kind of cold turkey, or can give you more so that to account for that future blood sugar. So basically, but that's what looping is. It's just putting all those things and making them work in sync as opposed to separately. And then that way, the people that I know that have been on it or are on it, they say it's basically just a lot less thinking that they have to do. So the looping thing runs in the background and it adjusts the amount of insulin that you get based on where your sugar is at that point. And then sometimes it can account for food, because not all foods just raise your blood sugars like at a constant rate. Some foods will raise it a little bit, like for the first few hours, and then like raise it really fast in the next hours after that, pizza being one of them. It's another tool in the type 1 management kit. It's going to be a lot more popular, I think, because now that up until this point, people have just been doing it themselves, like based on like just really simple technology that they can get to like connect your CGM to your pump. The Omnipod has started, it's recently, they cracked the code to figure out how to do that. But yeah, it's just another way of managing your insulin intake based on your sugars, so that you don't have to do as much thinking as you probably would have beforehand. And it's really helpful at night, because at night your sugars are going to fluctuate a lot. And the Omnipod can account for that, but only if you're aware of it. So, and you have to tell it what to do. But the loop is, it's like in real time. So if like my sugar is going to be high in the next hour, it will start dosing now to account for that, as opposed to me just like being high in an hour. But yeah, that's my understanding of it. If anybody's listening that knows looping, comment on the Instagram page.
Please.
Yeah, it does look really interesting. It's a little bit too involved for me, like, to do it myself, I think.
Yeah, it's like having to, you know, get the Riley link. I think messing with like different algorithms might hurt me more, or like cause, you know, more work for me right now. Whereas if I just wait for Omnipod to give me mine in a couple years, like I'll be okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I definitely need to look into it more. So please comment on Walt's Instagram.
Please. Yeah. And with your accounts too, like there's definitely a lot of positive ones, but I feel like there's no negative ones, which doesn't seem accurate to me. Like there has to be not perfect outcomes with it. I feel like if there were more of those, like just kind of like a balanced like idea of it, I would be more inclined. What do you think about it, Jillian?
All of this just sounded very complicated.
It is. That's the thing.
If it makes you feel better, and if it makes your life a little easier, I support it. Same. But people, please comment.
All right, Jillian, do you have any other questions?
Well, I was going to ask, like in 2019, I feel like everybody is a big focus and we're talking a lot about it in different ways, is social media, and whether it's great and whether humans are using it for great, or whether it's really ruining us all and humans are using it for bad. But it sounds like since, you know, it's been 19 years and 9 years since you've been diagnosed, it sounds like Instagram and this podcast, and it sounds like social media and, you know, just all of the improvements in technology have been a wonderful resource and asset for you all. But I was wondering if you could comment on maybe how it's been for you.
I think social media has been awesome. I don't really know any type ones in the wild, like I like to say. And it can definitely be like isolating or lonely, because the people in my life, like Jillian and my family and other friends, are so good about trying to understand. But I feel like if you don't live with it, there's just a certain, you're not going to understand like 100%. You know, there's only a certain level of understanding you can get to. And actually, I found Ask Me About My Type 1 because I was feeling kind of like lonely. So I was like, let me see if there are any diabetes podcasts. And so I actually started listening to this one. And then through the guests that like Walt has had on season one, I started following different people on Instagram. So that's kind of cool. I see it a lot more on my social media feed. But there's also a flip side to that, where I think the type 1 community is so good, but there's also sometimes like this need to show how well you're doing or how perfect it is. If I see another 24-hour like straight line Dexcom, I don't know. It just, or, you know, oh, my A1C is 5. Like, great, I'm so happy for you. But also, it makes me feel like a bad diabetic sometimes, because I think there's just this push to be so perfect. But there are also people who make a point to show their less than perfect numbers, which I really appreciate. It just makes you feel less alone.
Yeah, I agree. Especially for, I think, people like that went a route that I took, which I just didn't talk about my type 1. I didn't tell anybody that I knew. The people that did know, like, found out very, like, they happened to be there when I passed out one time, or, like, I dropped my pen and I had to explain it. But social media, it kind of gives you that, it gives you that buffer. So, like, you're seeing people with this or living the way you do, but it's not as, I guess you can retain a sense of vulnerability. Like, you don't have to be as vulnerable as kind of just going out in the wild and asking people if they have type 1, or seeing somebody with a pump and kind of introducing yourself and trying to get that. Because I would definitely see people with, like, you know, hardware, like a pump, or I'd see tubing or an Omnipod, and I was like, oh, wow, that person has what I have. But then I'd be very self-conscious about it and didn't want to interact with them. But social media makes that easier, especially for people that live out in the middle of nowhere, like in the States. There's a lot of little towns, like, in the middle of the country that have type 1s in them, but they're usually the only one. Or, like, they have to drive hours and hours to get to an endocrinologist to get their, you know, appointments and stuff like that. So it is a very isolating condition, especially when you're the only one that you know. And I think, yeah, so social media can definitely be helpful in that respect. But like Aaron says, it's not, social media isn't bad or good. It's just the way people use it can be bad or good. It just really depends on where you're at in your type 1 journey, I think. Like, the A1C thing is a pretty big debate. Some people, like, are all about it. Like, they love that accountability kind of a thing. But also, it kind of just, it's usually the people that have the good ones that do it. So it's very, like, social media in general, it's just the highlights of your life. Like, people typically pick the parts that they want people to see as opposed to the ones they don't. Which for type 1 is really, it can kind of give a more ideal example of it as opposed to what it really is. Because there's, I don't like using this phrase, but there's a lot of highs and lows, like literally and figuratively. It's not perfect 24-hour Dexcom lines, like Aaron was saying. And that's kind of the nature of diabetes. Like, diabetes is the body's inability to regulate blood sugar. Like, we have that, so our sugars aren't going to be perfect all the time. And I think social media can kind of shade that, like a gloss over that kind of thing. But if you follow people that, like, give you confidence or, like, just help you out, or, like, seeing people that remind you of yourself is really important, especially with something lifelong like type 1 is. So I'm definitely in the camp that it's good and bad in, you know, various ways. And I also love the story that you found this podcast. Definitely tell those kinds of stories, people. Actually, it's kind of fun. The reason why I know Erin is because she was the first person to review the show. So if you say nice things about it, you'll be on the show.
5 stars on iTunes. I recommend it to everybody.
Yes, thank you very much. Even if you have criticisms of it too, you can be on the show as well. I'm always looking for guests. Always looking for those reviews. Jillian, have you noticed anything from Erin after, or does she, like, mention the social media aspect of it? Did you notice anything, like a positive or negative reaction to those things?
I think so. I think for a while we would kind of send back and forth people who were on social and who were type 1 and who either, like, I don't know, had cool, like, stickers, or there's different, right, like, pod accessories. Mm-hmm. So we would send those back and forth, or she would say, like, this is so cool, or like, I don't, not Instagram influencers, but people who kind of do more lifestyle stuff on social, when they would post something related to type 1, we would send that back and forth. Nothing really negative. I feel like we've never touched on, like, negative, but Erin's a very positive person in general, so she wouldn't really talk about that stuff anyway.
Stay away from the negative, yeah.
I would never want to be negative about someone else's type one, because even though it's like we all have this same thing, it's definitely different person to person.
Yes, I agree. There's no one way to type one.
Yeah. My management is probably so different from so many other people. And what works for me might not work for you. I mean, obviously, like, you are doing blood tests and I love my Dexcom.
Yeah.
But it's just what works.
Yeah. I did the Dexcom for a summer. I got the chance to do it and I liked it a lot. It's just I haven't really gotten around to getting back onto it. Yeah, I don't know. Originally it was like, I don't want another thing on me, like, blah, 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 blah. But, like, nowadays, Dexcom specifically is very, very tiny. It's very inconspicuous. The Libre, I think, is a slightly smaller. It's just a different kind of CGM. And they have this other one, the Eversense, which seems, like, really neat. It's about the size of a penny. It's very, very tiny, very thin. Looks like a Tic Tac. And it's implanted into your arm. And it gives you readings to your phone for 3 months at a time, and that seemed really cool to me. But yeah, CGMs are getting a lot more sophisticated and a lot more accurate and a lot smaller and more inconspicuous. So yeah, someday I'll get back on it, but yeah, right now it's just what I'm doing works for me, so I'm not in too much of a hurry to change it. But I think social media also helps in that respect, because it opens people up to those different types of management. Because it's very, I've been doing this for 19 years. I've been on the same pump for 10. Type 1s can get very into habits, and it's like reluctant to change. Because like, oh, it's been working this long, like, I'm not going to change it. And which can be a little self-defeating, because like, we all change, and our type 1 is going to change with us. So it's definitely good to see those different management styles, different products, different tools that we have out there that can make managing things easier and just make us healthier in the long run. Erin, I also know you happen to work at JDRF, which...
I do.
And then, Jillian, I'm assuming you know what JDRF is now.
Yes, no, I do. Well, I always have, but yes.
Yeah. So what does that stand for? Do you know?
Me?
Yeah.
Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation.
Exactly, yeah.
Nailed it.
Yeah. So right now, I think they're kind of shying away from that, like, the full name. It's just JDRF, just because juvenile diabetes is not really what it's called anymore. Basically, it was, you know, founded to help kids with type 1, but now we're realizing that not everybody that gets type 1 is a kid. Like, I've had people on the show that were diagnosed in their, like, late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. I've met people that were diagnosed in their 50s and 60s and stuff like that. So it's definitely, like, one of those conditions that you can get pretty much any time. But Erin, what do you do at JDRF? How did you get involved with that? And was it intentional or?
It was actually a little bit of both, I would say. So, I mean, I knew about JDRF, obviously. They were, you know, pretty present when I was first diagnosed. Yeah. So we have a good partnership with Children's, and that's where I was treated. So, you know, I would go to like events, and I did walks for a couple of years until I went to college. And recently, so I was in AmeriCorps working at a YMCA, which was pretty cool, but that has, you know, just a year-long contract. And that was coming up. And so I was kind of looking around, didn't really know what I wanted. I like nonprofit, but it doesn't pay quite as well as anything like public or corporate. So I was like, I want out of nonprofit. I want a big girl paycheck. And Jillian is also in development. And she was like, no, I think you would be really good at development. So I'm like, okay, fine, I'll search for that too. And just one day on LinkedIn, I saw that JDRF New England chapter had an opening for a development assistant. So I applied and it just went from there. I was really excited about it. I was actually visiting Jillian at her apartment when I had my first phone call with HR. And then my interview at the office happened to be on my 9-year diversary. And so I was like, this is like the stars are aligning, like the universe is telling me that that's what this is. And then the day after, I also have a part-time job in retail. We got the diabetes loci that supports JDRF. And I was like, yep, this is it. And then later in that week, I got the phone call. And I've been working there for about a month.
Oh, wow. So very recently.
Very recent, yeah.
And so was that your, or is that your first, like, office job? It's like, have you ever had a job where you, that didn't revolve around type 1, that you had to, like, manage your type 1 in, as opposed to here, where JDRF is all about type 1, and people probably are very, a lot more understanding than your average, like, office environment?
So I kind of never had, like, a real office or, like, a desk at, you know, previous jobs. When I worked full-time retail, I was, like, I was one of the managers. So that can be tough because, you know, your hours shift all the time and you're on your feet all day. So sometimes I would be like, look, I know it's not my break time, but I have to just go sit down for 5 minutes in the back and get my blood sugar up. And my team was always super understanding. We have a policy that you have to have your phone locked up, but I get my Dexcom readings on my phone. So I'm like, you know, I need it with me for security. So anytime I would pull it out, you know, some people would give me looks that didn't know. And I'm like, look, I'm not, you know, messing around. I'm just checking my sugar, making sure everything's good. But for the most part, people have been pretty understanding about it, which has been great. But working at JDRF, it's even better because it's very normalized. There's one other person in the office with type 1. So that's kind of cool. But I think even if there weren't, there's, you know, I think they just have a deeper understanding of type 1 and what it means and how you have to manage. So it's been pretty great, even just, you know, being there and from my perception of my type 1.
I've never worked in an office where I was very open about my type 1 or where it was kind of like just understood as a thing that people have and people live with. But I have been to Type 1 camp as an adult and also did that Bike Beyond bike ride, the team of Type 1s. So being in those atmospheres of just being surrounded by Type 1 where everybody manages it, deals with it, can be very, it's a very different feeling than kind of just like, you know, average everyday life. I noticed it on the bike ride, that weight of type 1, like always being the one person that's managing your type 1 is, it's always you. So it's always a weight that you carry, but may not necessarily notice until like, you know, you're surrounded by it where everybody in a sense manages it and deals with it with you. So I definitely understand that kind of idea of that sense of just everybody getting it.
Yeah. It just feels better. I don't know.
Yeah.
It does. How to describe it. Yeah.
It just feels better. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easier and it's a really kind of like intangible kind of way. Like I would say if anybody's looking for that experience, I would definitely suggest camp, going to camp, working at a JDRF. But camp is probably a lot easier to get to, just like, you know, more readily available. But yeah. I would definitely encourage people to get those kinds of experiences in because it definitely reminds you, gives you that sense of normalcy that type 1 kind of robs you of very early on, especially depending on when you were diagnosed. It can get you back to that sense of normalcy that I think we all look for at some point.
And even, I mean, if you don't go to work for JDRF, there's so many like volunteer opportunities or New England has like a young adult program that it's literally just a group of type 1s getting together at a bar or going bowling, like, you know, every couple of months. So there are definitely ways to find and connect with other type 1s. And I don't think enough of us, or at least before working here and the social media part, I didn't really know about. So I think it's good to get that info out there.
And Jillian, have you noticed any kind of changes in Erin since you started working at JDRF? Have you noticed that kind of that lightness or that that difference between before and after?
Yeah, she's so happy. She calls me and tells me about her days. And I think it's nice. I always thought she'd be good at development, but I think that this is like that marriage of true passion and strengths, and like this is her life, you know? So she goes to JDRF and is somebody in development working towards giving people, you know, purpose and reason to give to diabetes research. She has all of that. It's her life. It's her story. And so the fact that she can do that every day at work, I think, is fulfilling professionally and personally for her. So she's so happy.
Well, that's good. And then, Erin, did you ever see yourself being like working in the type one space? Was that like being surrounded by type one? Like, you know, you think that we would be sick of it. Like, we wouldn't want to deal with it any more than we have to. But there's a lot of people that have type one that work in the type one space. And it seems to be, they seem to love it, like, a different sense than maybe someone that doesn't.
I think I had, like, considered it, but I really only thought a medical path was the way to be working with type 1. So, like, a dietitian, a CDE, some kind of nurse. But that's just not where my strengths lie. I, you know, for someone who had a hard time passing high school chemistry, like, that was just not going to be a career path. So I always thought it would be cool. And I, you know, have gone and, like, looked up, you know, classes and how hard and what the cost might be. But I never actively pursued it. Then when I, you know, saw the thing, the listing at JDRF, I was like, wait, yeah, there are so many other avenues to be able to work in and for this community that I didn't really think about before.
Yeah.
So I think development is really good.
Yeah, there definitely are a lot more aspects to type one than just the medical side of it. It would be great to have more type ones on the medical side of it, just because we have a better understanding of it, and we can kind of probably teach people and explain it to people a little bit better than someone that doesn't have it. But there is the development side. There's the camps that I go to. Most of the staff on those groups have type one, and they understand the importance of getting type ones together and having a fun weekend in the woods kind of thing. So there's definitely a lot of ways you can contribute and be involved in the type one community, the type one fight, I guess that you could call it, without necessarily just being on the medical side of it. So that's good for people to know, I think. Jillian, do you have any other burning type one questions?
Are you hopeful that in your lifetime there will be a cure?
Honestly, no. I think we're getting closer all the time, but I don't know that a cure is as close as people say it is. Like, my doctors, when I first got diagnosed, were like, oh yeah, there will be a cure in 5 years. And I've been hearing that for 9 years. So I might just be a little jaded. But on the other side of that, I think treatment has just exploded and become so much better so quickly. So I do think that if I'm not cured in my lifetime, I will definitely have something resembling a functional pancreas. I don't know what that will look like, but I do have confidence that treatment will constantly improve and make my type 1 something that continually gets easier to manage and kind of just go into the background. But I don't know that I'll actually see a cure.
Yeah, I agree. Cures are really hard to come by. Medicine's hard. The human body is very complicated, and it varies pretty drastically between person to person. Yeah, so there really aren't cures for a lot of things, like the common cold. There's no cure for that.
Right.
And we've been dealing with it for thousands of years. Type 1 diabetes has been around for thousands of years. And I think, like Erin says, like, technology is going to be the way to a normal life, or the closest thing to a cure that we're going to find, I think, or at least that I will see. Because now that all of the tech nerds are getting into the type 1 space, or like the medical device space, so not just specifically type 1, but just like medical monitoring in and of itself, there's going to be a lot more like just cool technology coming out. Like, you know, it's going to be a patch that we just wear on our bodies that not only takes care of insulin, but takes care of like low blood sugars by having like glucagon, like, you know, inside of it too, so that we don't have to worry about anything. And it'll be kind of thing like where you get diagnosed and it's just like, oh, you have to wear this for the rest of your life, whereas like we won't have to deal with all the math and all like the anxiety and the psychological kind of aspect of it anymore. But yeah, cures are hard. And well, I'm not necessarily like, I'm not waiting around for it kind of thing. Like, I've got other things to do. It's not something that I think about a whole lot, too. Like, this came up last season. We were talking about, like, oh, do you ever think about not having type 1? And it's like all of us were kind of stumped. It's like, you know what? Actually, no. Like, if we said, like, if a genie came up to us, like, one day, like, the first thing that we wished for would probably not be a cure. Like, that would be, like, the furthest thing from our mind, just because it's something that we deal with and we've gotten so used to, or at least the people that I was talking to had been so used to it. They've had it for 10 plus years, I think. And so it's just, like, not something that we worry too much about not having type 1, just because it's kind of just, like, so much a part of my life now that it's kind of hard to see it not there.
Can I ask you a question, Walt?
Please.
So I think similarly, I would thought my first genie wishes would not be to cure type 1, because that's just not, you know, I think maybe, like, the most important thing for me immediately. But how would you feel if someone came up to you and said, or I guess it's, would you trade your diabetes? Like, would you ever want to not be type 1? Because I think I see a lot on social media, people are like, you know, I have this thing, I didn't want it, but I wouldn't trade it.
I guess it would be situational. Oh, yeah, I would love to be able to trade my type 1 with somebody when I'm going to, like, get pizza. Like, you know, for that hour that I'm eating pizza, it'd be nice to, like, be able to give my type 1 to somebody else to, like, hold for a second. And then I can eat my pizza in peace. Kind of thing. But it's, like, it's very, like, you know, kind of trivial things like that. Given, like, in the recent years, I've kind of come to a better acceptance of my type 1, and I've actually used it to do kind of, like, pretty cool things that I think were really cool. So, and then without, literally, like, the bike ride that I was talking about earlier, had I not had type 1, I wouldn't have been able to do it, because the first, it was something that I started and kind of put together, but the first rule that I had was you have to have type 1 to be able to do this. And if I didn't have it, I wouldn't have been able to do it. And it was a really great experience. I learned a lot, about myself, about my type 1. So it's definitely, it's weird. I guess, like, you could probably catch me on a day where I would trade it, just because, you know, it's a, you know, a relatively high day and I'm particularly annoyed by it. But I don't think, like, overall, in general, I probably wouldn't trade it unless I'm getting a Tesla. I'd probably trade it for a Tesla.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. But yeah, other than that, I don't know, have you thought about it? Is it something that you would trade? Or has type 1 given you things that you probably wouldn't have had if you didn't have it?
I think more recently, like, my answer to the question used to be yes. I would give it away because, you know, yes, it's made me, you know, stronger and more independent and all that, and, like, a bigger advocate for myself and others. But I also think that other things in my life, like, not even related to type 1, would have given me those, maybe not particularly in the same way, but, like, still, like, that kind of strength. But now I think about it, I would have never come to JDRF, but would I have wanted to if I wasn't dealing with it? You know what I mean? Yeah, so I used to come down on the side that I would definitely give it away, but now I'm not so sure.
It's kind of, it depends on the day that they catch you, right?
Yeah.
Like working at JDRF now is probably a lot more meaningful because you have type 1, as opposed to, like, if you just kind of happened into the job. It's like, oh, yeah, I work at JDRF kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I help a lot of people, but it means a little bit more to you because you're so close to the cause and what they're trying to do.
Yes.
I kind of recognize that type 1 it can definitely make things harder, but it can also make those victories that we get a lot more meaningful, just because we accomplish them in addition to having type 1.
Yeah.
So it makes the lows lower, but the highs higher.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's why now I'm not so sure.
Jillian, anything you want to let people know before we go?
Just that Erin is a rock star every single day.
Thanks. I agree.
Yeah.
She has
pretty cool.
People can't see this, but she has a I guess a flag bandana on. It looks like the Field of Blue.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, it looks really rockstar. It's not though. Cool. Now that I see it,
it's not.
I
no,
I thought it was a flag. I was gonna say that's rockstarish.
No, I'm actually a big old weenie, and these are just flowers on my headband.
Just flowers. Okay.
But I'm glad that my perception is a little more badass. I'll try to keep that up.
Anything you want to let people know or wish that you wish people did know?
I think my type 1 definitely makes me different, but don't treat me different, if that makes sense. I'm open to questions when they come from a good place. It, like, don't feel bad about asking them, but definitely be tactful in your approach. Don't assume I can't do something. Maybe I can't do it at this moment, but it's not something that limits me.
Words to live by, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for... Yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having this platform. I like the idea. I like the idea of the type 1 and the type none. I think it's a really beautiful learning opportunity for everybody, and I think this is really cool that you do this.
Thank you so much. That was the idea.
And thank you for, bringing like more of a type 1 community to me, or at least like opening it up more to me. I'm really excited that we got to have this conversation.
Same. Thanks so much for coming out, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.